Just a second. Just to make sure that the recording was on and when we did it, we're going to bring the meeting to order of the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee on January 26th. Mr. Sparby, go ahead and take the roll.
Chairman Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chairman Woodard? Representative Mullery? Representative Dowd? Representative Gauthier?
Here.
Representative Grunhagen? Representative Hilty?
You betcha.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
Here.
Representative Kiefer?
Here.
Representative Kreisel?
Here.
Representative Leidiger?
Here.
Representative Mariani?
Yes, sir.
Representative McDonald?
Here.
Representative Moran? Representative Nornan?
Here.
Representative Slocum?
Present.
Representative Smith?
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Mullery here.
Go ahead. What's that?
Representative Mullery here.
Oh. Here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen.
Okay.
You sure you're here, Clinton?
First order of business will be the approval of the minutes. Has anybody looked over the minutes for November 3rd, 2011?
Yep.
If so, will somebody move the minutes? Representative McDonald.
I move the minutes.
Okay, Representative moves McDonald. Why don't you move both, if you would, May 4th, 2011, November 3rd, 2011.
So moved.
Okay, Representative McDonald moves the minutes of November 3rd, 2011 and May 4th, 2011. And any additions or corrections? Anybody have any problem with the minutes? If not, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, minutes approved. Now, I don't think we have any new members here today. We're all back from last year, so we don't have to go around and do introductions. But our new staff member almost promoted this, Mr. Pete Sparby. Why don't you say where you're from and a little background?
Good morning. I'm Pete Sparby. I'm the new committee legislative assistant to the Public Safety Committee. I went to William Mitchell, and I'm from North Oaks, Minnesota.
And Mr. Walsh, our fiscal analyst, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Mr. Chair, I've been a fiscal analyst for about 17 years here, and I can't believe I'm saying that, but formerly from Human Services Committee, and when Mr. Carter retired, I put in for this one, so glad to be here.
Welcome to both of you. We're glad to have you. Now, the first order of business is I will present a couple of bills. We're going to switch the agenda around a little bit, and we're going to take House File 1829 first, 1879 second, and I will have Representative Nornes come up and chair the meeting for me, and I'll take the table. Representative Nornes, you ready?
Representative Cornish, I want to present House File 1829.
I'd like to move House File 1829. We recommend it to pass and move to the General Register.
Proceed with your testimony.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, what we have here, House File 1829, is currently there's a statute that restricts county attorneys from carrying firearms while on duty. This bill, House File 1829, would change that and allow county attorneys to carry. I'm going to let the I've been blessed with a whole bevy of attorneys behind me that are actually going to speak to the bill and explain it, and they can do it in a lot better detail and the reasons why and wherefore. The interesting thing about this bill is some people think, somewhat accused of having a knee-jerk reaction to a problem up in northern Minnesota, but actually this bill came to me in written form some 5 days before the assault took place up in Cook County. And while we were considering it and looking at the language, and the attorneys were expressing their concern how dangerous the atmosphere and environment was in our courts, family court, divorce court, any kind of court right now with the volatility there, this unfortunate, tragic happening occurred in Cook County. And Mr. Scanlon, the attorney that was assaulted, will also be here to testify on either bill he wishes, but I think the second bill that we take up. So one thing I want to clarify also is there seemed to be some concern about the definition of on duty, and people were worried about that. We'll cover that. We don't really want to make any definitions of on duty and be restrictive on it, because a county attorney or prosecutor, assistant county attorney, could be on duty in a duck boat if he gets a phone call. It could be on duty at a seminar sponsored by the county or sent there at their expense. He could be on duty just, or he or she, anywhere in the state. And so if we start seeing in the workplace or language like that, we're just going to mess everything up. The other thing I wanted to clarify is this bill doesn't restrict the judges from restricting firearms in their arena. All this addresses is simply the county attorney's ability to carry on duty. It does not supersede or trump the judge's ability to restrict firearms in the courtroom. So with that, I'd like to have the first testifier come up, my county attorney in Blue Earth County, Mr. Ross Arneson, and begin his presentation, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
And we will have, if there are some opposition, we can bring them in at the end if that's okay.
Good morning.
Mr. Arneson, welcome to the committee.
I'm sorry.
I'm just welcoming you to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Ross Arneson, Blue Earth County Attorney, Mankato, Minnesota. First, I'd like to thank Representative Cornish for referring to a bevy of attorneys as a blessing. I don't think I've ever heard that before. This is a pretty modest bill. The bill that's before you would give county attorneys and assistant county attorneys the same carry rights as currently enjoyed by the public defenders, the court administrator and the court administrator's staff, judicial law clerks, and the private bar. So it's not really something beyond that. When I first went into county attorney work back in 1981 and became aware that there's a restriction for county attorneys and assistants to carry on duty, it was, you know, kind of annoying, the fact that we were treated as subservient to public defenders, but it really didn't become an important issue to me until an experience that one of my assistants had back in 2007, and that assistant, Chris Rovney, is here, and he'll be testifying right after me. This bill is about, in my opinion, personal safety, not courtroom security. Some people said, oh, it means you're going to be carrying guns while in the courtroom, you know, you're going to be wearing a gun while you're giving a closing argument. Well, the public defenders aren't doing that now. The court administrators aren't carrying in the courthouse now. The judicial law clerks aren't carrying in the courthouse now. The private bar isn't doing it either. And again, what we're simply asking for is the same rights that those individuals have. The issue of personal safety is a legitimate concern. Everyone knows about the Cook County case, but this is simply one in a string of cases where county attorneys, assistant county attorneys, have faced personal safety threats. In 2004, Beltrami County, shots were fired into the home of an assistant county attorney by an individual that assistant county attorney was prosecuting. The individual who fired those shots was later convicted of two counts of second-degree assault, felony assault. 2007, my assistant had an experience. 2008, the Morrison County attorney and county board were held at gunpoint by a gunman until that gunman was shot and killed by law enforcement. Everyone knows about the Cook County case. Wednesday of this week, a jury convicted an individual in Todd County of stalking the county attorney. And I think every county attorney's office can relate experiences similar to that. This is not controversial. There's a editorial in our local paper, the Mankato Free Press, and if I could read you just a bit of it. A guy who makes late-night deliveries can carry a handgun for protection while he goes about his work, assuming he has a legal permit and his boss doesn't mind. county prosecutors who try to send violent people to prison for a living can't carry a handgun anytime they're on the work clock. Considering there have been virtually no problems among average citizens who carry legally, despite predictions of blood flowing in the streets when the law passed 6 years ago, it's difficult to imagine any problems in allowing prosecutors to carry a gun for protection. And just a bit from an editorial in the New Ulm Journal, we have to agree with area county attorneys who have expressed their opinions in letters to the editor that they are citizens too and should have the right to have the rights all other citizens have to carry guns. We still think courtrooms and courthouses are no place for guns, and that stronger security measures should be taken to keep them out. But county attorneys should not be handicapped when it comes to their own safety. The media that I have seen is in favor of this. It's supported by the County Attorneys Association and by the Sheriff's Association. And perhaps most noteworthy, it's not going to cost you anything. If you have any questions for me, I'll be glad to take them. But again, we have some other speakers who are prepared to testify as well.
Representative Mulroy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I forgot your name, but
Ross Harrison.
You talked about shots fired into the home. Can't they get a permit like anybody else for that type of situation?
If this bill is passed, you'd still have to have a permit if you're going to carry out in public.
But I'm saying you talked about shots fired into a county attorney's home. Wouldn't they have the right to have a permit anyhow in that situation?
Mr. Arneson.
Well, there's two different issues. Having a right to have a permit, and whether this law is passed or not, county attorneys and assistant county attorneys can apply for a permit. The question is whether you can carry a gun while on duty. And, you know, if I'm going from my office out to the parking lot, you know, I can't be carrying a gun now because there's a, you know, I'm doing it while I'm work. Today, coming up here, you know, I'm on the clock today. I'm on duty. I couldn't be carrying a gun today even if there's somebody that's out to get me. If I got a call today that somebody I prosecuted has recently been released from prison and is planning to come to kill me, you know, I might, under those circumstances, want to be carrying a firearm, assuming I have a permit and doing everything else legally. I can't do that under current law.
Representative Mulroy, any more questions?
I think I understand, but my question would be, yes, they can have a gun in that situation that's
sure.
cited.
Yes, with or without a permit, in their own home.
Mr. Chair, unless you happen to be on the phone on a case, then in your own duty. And so that's the complexity involved here.
Representative Leifker.
Thank you. Currently, most judges don't allow any kind of firearms in the jury room. Is that correct? Or even in the courtroom?
Well, we got a number of different districts. In the 5th Judicial District, where I come from, there's an executive or administrative order issued by the chief judge that prohibits possession, not just carrying, but possession of a firearm in a courthouse complex unless you're a licensed peace officer. So like the bailiffs are armed. And that would still apply whether this bill passes or not. Now, there's an exception to that. You can get permission. If you get permission from the sheriff or from the chief of police, then you would be allowed to carry. And if they granted permission, you know, they could put restrictions on that.
Representative Leidig.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, would this bill allow you to, if the judge allows it, you'd be able to carry it in the courtroom? I just wanted to kind of be clear on that. And then, you know, something that's always been a question to me is, you know, if you can't bring a weapon into a courthouse complex, then where is it kept when you're authorized to use it any other time? You know, coming, going to work and going from work. Where do you keep it,
Mr. Arneson?
It could be, again, I can only speak for our district. In our district, there's an executive or administrative order by the chief judge saying that if you're not a licensed peace officer, you cannot possess a firearm in a courthouse complex unless you get approval from the sheriff or chief of police. So if you wanted to carry it in and then, you know, turn it in at the sheriff's office or keep it in a locked drawer or something like that, in our district, if this bill passes, I would have to get permission from either the sheriff or chief of police. And the same would apply to any other lawyer. That any other lawyer can do it now if they get permission. I can't, because yep. there's a state law saying I can't do it. So,
thank you.
Well, Mr. Goldman?
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. And Representative Cornish, who is your next witness?
My name is Christopher Ovney. I'm an assistant Blue Earth County attorney. I am the attorney that Mr. Arneson talked about, who had the, I guess, the contract at the time taken out on his life. Just as, first off, I'd like to thank the chairman and the rest of the committee for having us and listening to us today. The important thing I want to stress is that before I get into what happened in my case, is that this bill doesn't ask us, we're not asking for any greater rights than any other citizen in the state of Minnesota has. We're just asking for parity. That's all we want. And it's especially important when you have a group of people, like assistant county attorneys or prosecutors, that because of their profession are put into a more dangerous situation just because of the people that they meet, the people that they have contact with. And one of the people that I had contact with was a gentleman named Leonard Cook. He was a drug dealer. His nickname was Cosmo. He wanted to be a rapper. And I was prosecuting him for a first-degree controlled substance crime. He was selling a lot of crack cocaine in the city of Mankato. And I'm an optimist, so I assume I was doing too good of a job on his case. So he decided to talk with someone and arrange and conspire with that person to shoot me and kill me. He wanted to kill me, he wanted to kill the judge, and he also wanted to kill the head of the drug task force that was involved in this case. Luckily, as with most criminals, they're sometimes not that intelligent, and the person he was conspiring with was a confidential informant with the police. He had been released on bail, and he was in Wisconsin, and the person that he conspired with try to assassinate me was working with the authorities over there. What was particularly troublesome is that he had me, the judge, and the head of the drug task force under surveillance. He knew where we lived. He knew our schedules, and that all came out when he was when he talked to the confidential informant, who later informed police of the plot. And so this is a situation where we were under surveillance, and he could have attacked us at any time. And thankfully, he got caught, and the person that he talked to was a confidential informant. But we did not know if he talked to anyone else. We didn't know if he had been in discussions with other people. This particular person had a lot of gang affiliations. And he was from Chicago, and I don't know what particular gang at this point. I can't remember, but it's very likely he could have talked to other people. And he was talking about buying 9mm machine guns to use those against us. He had a whole plan. And thankfully, the person that he initially conspired with was working with the police. Otherwise, he may have been successful. And at the time, our offices were away from the courthouse. And we had to walk a block or two to get to court. So we were exposed during that time. We were exposed when we come to our homes. We come to work when we're out at the grocery store. And the point was made that technically at this point, if I am out on a weekend and I get a phone call and I have my gun on me, I technically have to take the gun off and then answer the phone if it's from the police. And that's kind of an absurd result. But, you know, we take our jobs very seriously. We believe and we try to do what's right, follow the law. And in this particular situation, the law as it is now, for lack of a better word, is discriminatory towards county attorneys because we do not have the same rights as other citizens. And it's particularly sad because by virtue of what we do for a living, we're put in an elevated, I guess, zone of danger. And basically all we're asking and all this bill asks for is parity with the rest of the citizens in the state. And that's nothing more, nothing less. And I just appreciate having the opportunity to talk to you about that.
Thank you very much. Members, have any questions? Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe my question's probably for Representative Cornish, but you can phone a friend if you need to. I don't think you will. You got one there, and he's a good guy. Does anything in this bill limit the authority of a court to prohibit firearms or ammunition in the courthouse complex?
Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slocum, not that I know of. In fact, I've been told just the opposite, that this does not prohibit or limit the court's authority to exercise their limitations on the possession of firearms or ammunition.
Thank you. Can I just follow with one more,
please? Representative Slocum, go
ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if one county attorney, one county allows firearms, and another judge decides no, that we can't, or the county attorney decides no, we can't restrict this, doesn't that create kind of a patchwork instead of a solution? So you'll have one county where the county prosecutors can carry, and the other next county over maybe where they can't.
Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Slocum, it does create different systems, but there's not that many judicial districts, and somebody going in the courtroom should know before they go in whether they can or can't carry, and most have signs. And it would be no different right now than the thousands of patchwork we've got on businesses that post, and some businesses post, some don't. Just a whole multitude of different choices there. And the courts, of course, I would encourage the courts to allow it, but being me, but some won't and some will.
Thank you.
Representative Mulderby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and either one of you can answer. My first question is, can a judge then bar the guns from the entire courthouse or just from the judicial area, or the, let's say, the courtroom, then a little bigger is the judicial area? Can they bar them from the entire courthouse complex? That's my first question. And then what about, can the individual judge, what if there's, you know, more than one judge in a courthouse?
I'll take a whack at it, and then Attorney Revenue will. But it's my idea that it depends on how the court complex is defined and how it's arranged and designed in an architecture. In other words, if the court complex contains within its boundaries other offices and it's considered a court complex per se, then the judge would have the authority to do that. Now, if the court was like we used to have it in some counties where the court was separated from the county attorney's office, then there would be, you know, a different set of circumstances. But maybe the assistant county attorney can help me.
Mr. Rubin, that's my understanding too. In fact, I know I've heard that some judges have actually sat down and said, okay, this, and with the magic mark, and say, this is where it's prohibited if it's a massive complex. You have to realize that a lot of times, though, a lot of courthouses out state may have county attorney's offices away from the courthouses, and then you're in the situation where you have to actually travel to the courthouse. But so that's always a concern. Additionally, as far as the prohibition, if there's a number of judges in a district, usually there's a chief judge that handles the administrative functions of that judicial district, and that's the person that usually issues the order about who or what is the zone that you're not supposed to have a firearm in. And that would apply to every judge in the district. They have to follow the order of that chief judge. So it would be each judicial district, I assume, would be able to delineate what parts of the court complexes are off limits, and I am sure that they get together and talk within the district about what's the appropriate parameters to have that restriction on. But it's a chief judge. It's an administrative order from the chief judge that controls.
Senator Mulray,
just to make so the chief judge can overrule, even though he's in a different county of the judicial district.
Yeah,
can overrule. But even the more important question is, I guess I didn't realize the chief judge has control over everything in a courthouse complex.
Well, I don't know if that's the case. I know that the judge has an inherent authority to control security within the judicial part of the complex. But every courthouse complex, you know, some courthouse complexes have all the county functions in it, and some have some, you know, just in Blue Earth County, we have a criminal justice complex, which has the county attorney, probation, and the courthouse, and the sheriff's department. And they've The problem in Blue Earth County is that the order issued by the administrative judge is from the old courthouse, which was a single entity, and it hasn't been amended, but we still, I guess, view it as controlling the whole complex. But the chief judge, I guess, of the judicial district is the one that would decide, obviously with in consultation, I would assume, with the other judges, what the appropriate parameters are for the restriction. So it all depends. You know, it's basically the judge's inherent authority, from my understanding, to control security in their area.
Mr. Chairman, I think to make it clear, you don't know the answer to my question, really, because I'm asking a question, and I don't know. Maybe staff knows the answer, and maybe nobody here knows the answer. I don't know, but that clearly is not an answer.
Mr. Chair, if
Representative,
if I could just clarify again that this does not address that statute, and whatever they do now, they can do then, and it does not limit the judge's authority. This. What we're addressing is the ability of the county attorney to carry on duty. So what the judges are doing right now, they can do in the future. This bill doesn't affect their ability to do anything there.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is actually a question for Mr. Diebel. Looking at the bill, it says, notwithstanding Section 626.84, Subdivision 2, I assumed that that was where we would find the prohibition that we're concerned with here, but it doesn't appear that that's the case. I just looked at the section of statute, and I'm wondering why that's referred to in the bill, and if we could have some explanation of how that works, because I don't know where in law the prohibition that we're concerned about exists. It appears not there. So where is it, and why are we referencing 626.84?
You're addressing your question to whom?
Well, to staff, whoever can answer that question.
All right. Whoever wants to do it.
I'm Jim Cleary from House Research. Mr. Diebel and I work very closely together on firearms issues. You're right, Representative Hilty, that is the section of law, 626.84. Subdivision 2, which currently restricts all local government employees from carrying firearms while on duty. This would this bill would exempt, of course, county attorneys. Now, if you're referring to the inherent authority of courts to further restrict, I'm not aware of any place that occurs in statute. It's the inherent authority of a court, and I'm not a constitutional scholar or anything, but I do accept that that's a very important authority, and if the courts are here, they could probably speak to that. But we, as the author has noted, the bill does not change that that inherent authority of the courts to further restrict if they choose to. This, right now, even if the courts would allow firearms carry by county attorneys, they cannot do so because this particular statute that you cited prohibits them from doing so. This would at least remove that burden. I in our discussions with county attorneys, we were told that most county attorneys would probably allow their assistant county attorneys to carry to the extent that police and other authorities, the sheriff and other court authorities would allow them to carry.
Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cleary, am I correct in my understanding that this prohibition is not specific to county attorneys?
That's correct. It's specific to all local government employees. That's correct.
Thank you.
And so we don't cite, if I could just follow up, so we don't cite the judicial authority, but we accept it.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes, thank you. Representative Cornish, my concern with this bill is that we actually don't go far enough and almost require our district attorneys to carry actually into the courtroom as well. My concern is, of course, that they can
that they can carry firearms into the complexes. And of course, if they want to comply within, or if they have to comply with what the judge says, that that there is a place for them to then deposit their weapon, you know, safely within the complex, so that they can carry in transit. And are you satisfied that we go far enough with the way it's written now?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Leidiger, I'm probably never satisfied with totally with the gun bill. But since we brought the County Attorneys Association and the Sheriff's Association onto this bill, and we worked on the language so specific right down to the word, I'm reluctant to change even a word of it. But I have some things that I would love to see too, but I have given my commitment that this is the form that it would stay in. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, my concern has to do with courthouse, courtroom security, and although this bill doesn't necessarily address it, my concern would be to introduce any additional weaponry, be an attorney, into the courtroom, courthouse setting. And it sounds like, from what I understand what you're saying, in the bill, that would not be the case. Is that correct?
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes, the only intent of this bill is to allow the county attorney or the assistant county attorney, with the county attorney's approval, to carry into the courtroom. It doesn't talk about any other officers. Is that what you're getting at, or what was your specific
Representative
question?
Johnson.
Well, I want to ensure that there's no additional weapons, such as from a prosecuting attorney, county attorney, brought into the courtroom. So I think that's a bad idea.
I can Rubnick try to help. As it stands now, this bill does not allow any additional weapons, because most courtrooms, especially in the 5th Judicial District, there's a prohibition of bringing firearms into the courtrooms or courtroom complexes. That applies to public defenders, private attorneys, anyone. It applies to prosecuting attorneys also. If that prohibition wasn't there, then public defenders could bring guns in, other attorneys could bring guns in, but prosecuting attorneys still could not. So all this bill does is set up parity with everybody else. We're still controlled by the administrative orders of the judges as to courtroom security.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you agree with me that it would not be a good idea to bring additional guns or weapons of any sort into the courtroom?
Well, I'd have to speak personally, and personally I don't think it's a good idea, because you have trained, licensed peace officers that are bailiffs that have those. And I'm sure they would not want additional guns in the courtroom, because they want to know who has a gun and who doesn't. And that's, frankly, that's not an issue in this bill, thankfully. It's just the only issue in this bill is to allow parity between all the other citizens in the state of Minnesota and county attorneys. And it's not going to add any guns to the courthouse complexes, and all it's going to do is allow assistant county attorneys and county attorneys to be a little more safe when they're in the course of their employment. That's all.
Representative McGonigal, do you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Question for Mr. Rovney. Thank you. In most cases, in a dangerous situation in the Blue Earth County scenario, I would imagine that there's the bailiffs are there and they're armed and they're anticipating hoodlums coming in and the potential of danger. Is that correct?
I would assume so,
Rovney.
However, this bill doesn't address that. This bill has nothing to do with courtroom security, frankly. That's a different issue. This bill just deals with the prosecuting attorneys having the ability to carry while on duty, subject to the restrictions already imposed by administrative orders of the judges.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative.
Yeah, I think I'm aware of the bill. I'll make my point. Earlier in your testimony, you said that you, in transition from an office to the courthouse,
yep,
you were potentially in danger. Mm-hmm. The article says there was a sniper positioned by the courthouse, yep, and knew exactly where he could shoot, mm-hmm, and kill, yep, before entering the courthouse. Therefore, there's no bailiff following you, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
So therefore, you are, the county attorneys, are in danger.
Absolutely.
Once they get to the door of the courthouse, mm-hmm, based on the court, the judge, they can decide whether or not they allow any future firearms for those who are carrying.
That would be a real judicial decision, I believe, yes.
Right. But at a dangerous case, at a high-profile case, the bailiff in the courtroom is armed and there at all times.
I guess I can't speak to that because I don't know what the practice is in every county in Minnesota. In Blue Earth County, that's typically the case. But in a situation like that, in my particular case, I would like to have a gun with me as I would probably drive to the courthouse, even though it's a block, because then I'd have additional protection, and then I would be able to leave my gun in the car so I could still follow the mandates of the court. But I cannot do that at this time. I could not do that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator McDowell.
So then, based upon the testimony, it seems evident that county attorneys and assistant county attorneys in high-profile cases can be in danger and have inadequate possibilities to protect themselves. And if you're stating that in some courthouses the bailiff may not always be there and may be distracted, there's no way for a county attorney in a high-profile case, because we know it's not the truth in every case, is in risk and has no way to protect himself.
That's absolutely correct.
And then I'll further surmise, Mr. Chairman, that if a high-profile case like in Blue Earth County, the judge decides that a county attorney cannot carry, even though this law would be valid, he's in danger again, he or she.
I would have to agree.
So we have another problem.
Not in Blue Earth County, because the administrative order that was issued in the 5th Judicial District allowed the sheriff or the chief of police to allow someone to carry if given approval. So there are ways to deal with that courtroom security, but that's not what the bill is. and I don't want to keep coming back to it, but this bill is only asking for parity with other citizens of the state of Minnesota. At this point, the way the law is written, it is discriminatory against public servants, particularly county attorneys and assistant county attorneys, whose job it is to protect the citizens of the state of Minnesota at sometimes peril to their own safety. And all we're asking for is parity with everyone else.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative McDonald.
Yes, no, it has my full support.
Thank you.
I just was making a point for my own vote so I can vote yes or no. And you answered it very clearly. Thank you.
Well, I apologize. I'm a lawyer. Sometimes I speak more than I should. So
I'm a politician, and sometimes I speak more than I should as well.
No. Thank you.
We need to move on here. We have another bill to get to this morning. Representative Gauthier, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Mr. Cleary, because I want to be clear. I just heard the testifier talk about having the same rights of other Minnesotans. But when you look at the bill, it talks about Section 624 that prohibits local public employees from carrying weapons. So actually we're asking for an exemption, not a parity issue. Is that correct?
Mr. Cleary? I'm sorry, your last couple of words
the testifier talked about county attorneys having an exception or a parity with other Minnesotans. And what we're really saying is you have an exemption.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, and
Mr. Perry.
Essentially, both are true. The exemption would put county attorneys on parity with other attorneys, other state attorneys, for example, as they said.
Okay.
In that setting, so it does provide parity. That's one way of looking at it. Technically, I see the words and I see exemption from a current restriction. If I could make one further point, this bill does not, just for clarity, this bill does not affect anything about the carry law for county attorneys or anybody else when carrying off-duty. you know, whether that's in the parking lots or when going out to lunch off duty or in their homes or on vacations or anything. This bill does not affect any of that. The current law does allow employers of all types, public and private, to restrict carry by their employees on duty. The current law does. So this particular bill, something that hasn't been mentioned, does have a clause saying they may carry on duty unless restricted by the county attorney. So county attorneys would still also have the authority to restrict assistant county attorneys from carrying under the bill. It doesn't usurp that authority. But they already have that authority under the general carry law anyway. So they dovetail.
Representative Gauthier.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, I'm really struggling with how I'm going to vote on this. And my question is, and I understand, you know, county attorneys are asking for this, and, you know, we lived and breathed the shooting in, up in, on the North Shore for days in our area of town. I'm wondering why judges weren't included. Because surely they might be just as much risk.
Representative Cornish? I could be maybe stand correction on this, but I think we have quite a number of pro-gun judges that carry a pack and heat under their robes. I don't think anything restricts them from doing it, and so I don't think they need an exemption.
Representative Leidiger?
No, I'm.
Oh, okay, all right. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in favor?
Could I touch on the last issue?
Or Mr. Arneson?
Thank you. Judges aren't restricted from carrying now. Public defenders aren't restricted from carrying now. The court administrator and her staff are not restricted from carrying now. This would simply give county attorneys and assistant county attorneys the same rights they have, no more, no less. So if the public defenders aren't carrying in the courtroom now, and private attorneys aren't carrying in the courtroom now, and the court administrator and her staff aren't carrying in the courtroom now, there's no reason to expect that county attorneys and their assistants are going to be following a different practice.
Representative Gauthier?
I understand that, and there's nothing in this bill that prevents anybody coming into the courthouse with a gun. I mean, we still run that risk.
Again,
unfortunately, just like at the Capitol, we run that risk every day.
Mr. Arneson?
Sure. In Blue Earth County, again, there's an order that applies to everybody. Nobody has to follow that order.
Right.
You're committing a crime if you don't, but if you're planning on killing somebody, violating a judge's administrative order probably isn't a big concern of yours.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is anyone else in the audience wishing to testify in favor of the bill?
Yeah, I think we got Jim.
If we can keep it as brief as possible. Welcome. Identify yourself for the committee, please.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'll be brief. We support this bill. We support the clarification of this bill. As you know, sheriffs are required in this state to do the backgrounds and to issue the permits to carry under 624. Under 626, the clarity is not there as to whether a county attorney is a person that is on duty 24 hours a day because they're an elected official. And we've always had a question, if that's the case and you're really on duty 24 hours a day, 626 may say we can't even issue you a permit. And that's an individual protection issue that we have a problem with as sheriffs that we want you to clarify. We've worked hard to try to make this a very narrow window for all the reasons that have been discussed here. I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
If not, we have Heather Martins. Representative Cornish, did you have anyone else?
No.
Okay.
My good friend. One more support.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Identify yourself for the record, please. And
I'm Paul Bowmaster. I'm the Rice County Attorney. I'm also the president of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and our association does support this bill. And again, it is not a bill that gives any greater advantage to the prosecutors of our state who are expected to enforce the laws. There's a question about what's going to stop anyone from walking in with a gun. Well, we as prosecutors generally believe we should follow the law, and that's what stops us from just walking in with guns.
Reference to you.
I do think that this bill will do the clarification that Jim Franklin just talked about and make it clear that we are on par with the other employees, other people who have to work in the courthouse facilities. And we would ask that all of you support this bill. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony. Heather Martins, you're... You're going to do this
Hi.
Together?
Please
identify yourself.
Yes, my name is Heather Martins. I'm Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence. And,
my name is Thompson and Darren Comey. I'm the Board Chair for Watch Minnesota, a court monitoring agency.
Our Please main proceed. Concern about this bill was the possibility that it would require judges to allow guns in the courthouse. That's our biggest concern. I think we could, and we're prepared to talk about the risks of doing that. I think there's some agreement around the table that that's a bad idea. And so our concern is that this bill says a prosecutor can carry a gun while on duty. They are on duty in the courthouse. So that presents a conflict with another part of the statute, which Representative Slocum's amendment addresses. There is a part of the statute that gives the courts the authority to decide whether to restrict firearms in their buildings, and we would be in favor of adding that amendment, which specifically says this does not. There's nothing in here that says that takes away the authority of the court to restrict firearms in that courthouse complex. And I think Representative Slocum has given you that amendment. It sounds like everybody's in agreement. The county attorneys say that's not the intent of the bill, to allow guns in the courthouse. So I think it's important that it be noted that that is not the intent. And I can speak to, if it is the intent, we can speak to why it's a bad idea to have guns in the courthouse. My question is that something that is Representative Slocum going to be adding that amendment? It would change our response.
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, what I did was I have this amendment, but I decided after conversation to just ask it as a question, and Representative Cornish did clarify that it does not change the authority.
Okay, so the belief is that it would be interpreted to mean that there's no conflict with the part of statute that's in your right. amendment.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I mean, Ms. we Martins. Would prefer that it be explicit, because to us it looks like on duty conflicts directly with the judge's authority to restrict guns in the courthouse. So we do object in that respect. As for the other part of the bill, prosecutors carrying guns, we have concerns about prosecutors' security, absolutely, and courthouse security as well. And we wish that that would ensure their security. Unfortunately, as the case of James Davis, the council member who was gunned down in council chambers in New York City while carrying a concealed carry weapon, a gun, does show that it's not going to guarantee safety, and there are a whole host of other problems with doing that. But that's not the part of the bill that we are objecting to strenuously, which is allowing guns in the courthouse. We think the best way to improve the safety both of our county attorneys and the public is to ensure that the people who pose that risk do not have easy access to a firearm, as they often do today. And that's why we are for better courthouse security, weapons screening. We are also for stronger laws that prevent people who pose a risk from getting a gun in the first place. We feel that's the best way to protect county attorneys who are protecting the public, absolutely. So, so I think, did you want to speak in addition to that?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Bartons. And I, Thompson is your first name, right?
Yes.
Yes.
You'll have to help me with your last name.
Darren Comey.
Okay. Did you have something to add?
Nothing to add, but just to reinforce, all we're asking is for clarity. When I read the bill, it looks like you can bring a gun with you wherever you are on duty, and we would like clarification on that issue.
Yeah, I think the question would be for the county attorney is indeed that is the intent, right, that they're that it not change the rules about courthouses.
That's okay. Our understanding.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify against the bill? Otherwise, Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd just like two clarifications, and I'm sorry I had to step out for about 5 minutes if I missed it, but do they have to have, two questions, do they have to have the same training as anybody else with a permit? And my second question is maybe for somebody from, I see Jim out there, from the sheriffs, what do most of the bailiffs, I believe, are sheriff's deputies, and I guess I'm wondering what their position would be on adding, because they're the ones that are supposed to keep track of safety in the courtroom, and I guess I'm wondering what their position would be on adding guns, because I know sheriff's deputies in Hennepin County that are totally against anybody but them having guns in there. They don't want the judges. They don't want anybody else having them. So
I think we can get a quick answer on both of those questions. First of all, on the training, Representative Cornish.
I'll pick the first one, and then the answer is yes. They would have to have the same requirements and criteria for training that anybody else would have. If you get to carry the pistol with a permit, you have to go through the classroom and the range and the same training. And I think Sheriff Franklin can answer the second one.
I'm sorry if I missed your testimony. But
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, sheriffs again. The question is, do we support this? Yes, we do. Are we concerned about weapons in the courtroom? Yes, we are. You've already alluded to weapon screening that's available in certain areas. We also do high-profile risk assessment on cases where putting screening in place, especially on high-profile cases, is very important, and it's a part of the protocol. With regards specifically to your question, we are in support of this. We do want less guns for us to have to deal with inside of a courtroom, should there be something with that. And again, a judge's judicial order in all parts of the state. I'm not aware of any place in the state that currently a judge is allowing guns into the courtroom in the state of Minnesota. They're all covered currently under judicial order. And so we support that portion of it. Again, back to the security. And again, we're working with the judges to try to help develop protocols and risk assessments with the courts so that we can add additional screening or securities as may be necessary for those emotionally charged cases where there is a heightened risk of concern.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Any other discussion before we move on to a vote? Representative Cornish, you want to wrap it up and
I would
make
just
a final motion?
Renew my motion to move to pass 1829 and House File 1829 to the General Register.
Okay, all of those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries and goes to the General Register. Next bill.
The next bill will be House File 1879, and I'll describe this rather quickly because we were actually supposed to have a couple more bills after this one. And this would be to add the prosecuting attorneys to a list of individuals here that if they're assaulted would give an enhanced penalty. And I'll have the County Attorneys Association representative come up and explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Scannell. I am the Cook County Attorney.
Welcome, and you're going to do this together?
Paul Bowmaster, the Rice County Attorney. I'm also the President of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association.
Okay. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And you can proceed with your testimony.
At our last County Attorneys Association board meeting, the board voted, I believe, unanimously to support the legislation that is in front of the committee. I made a statement at that meeting, which I can make very simply here. The reason that we are supporting adding prosecutors to this legislation is that when you attack a prosecutor in any way who is trying a case in the state of Minnesota or anywhere in the United States of America, you are, in essence, attacking the public and attacking the core of our civil and secular judicial system. Our criminal justice system is one of the harbingers of our free and democratic society. When you attack a prosecutor, you are not just attacking an ordinary citizen. You're making a political statement that the charges against you, that the crime that the state believes you have committed, should somehow be nullified. And I think that's what occurred in my situation, and I strongly support this legislation, as does the County Attorneys Association.
Any questions? If not, you can proceed. Mr. Bowmaster, is it?
Mr. Chair, I do ask the members of this committee to support this bill. As County Attorney Scannell has stated, this does, I think, stand for the proposition that there is an added penalty for attacking the state. The prosecutors are the representing the state of Minnesota. When we file a complaint, we file it under the name of the state of Minnesota versus whoever the defendant is. It is our name on the bottom of that complaint. It is the prosecutor who stands before all in the court and says, I do not believe this person is innocent. He does not have the presumption of innocence with me. I believe he is guilty. I believe I can prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That is what a prosecutor has to do day in and day out. Not surprisingly, oftentimes defendants, as the embodiment of the state, look at us as the cause of all their troubles. We are the ones holding them accountable. We are the ones enforcing the laws that you pass. We ask that you make it clear that simply attacking that embodiment does not change the fact that you will be held accountable. In fact, you will be held accountable for the assault on the state, not only for the crime that you thought you were going to get out of by assaulting that prosecutor, but also you're going to be held to a higher and accountability for that action and an enhanced penalty for that action of not only the personal assault on the prosecutor, but that assault on the state. And I would ask that you support that, and I'll stand for any questions as well. Tim is here to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, first question from Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To any of the witnesses, I guess, if this is a good idea, why are we not including judges?
I'm not here opposing including anybody that represents the state. However, the judge is supposed to be a neutral magistrate. I mean, that is a distinction that we carry only in the court. We are the ones who have the burden of proving the guilt. The presumption of innocence doesn't weigh into my calculation. I am the accuser. I am the one who is going to present evidence. I'm the one who's going to argue to a jury of this person's peers that they are guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So there is a distinction there. A judge, I don't know if I draw the distinction or not, but I don't presume to speak for the judges. I don't know if they're here to speak, to be included. I'm not here speaking against that at all.
I certainly would support adding the judges if that's what the judges wanted to have happen.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does your argument then also hold true for witnesses and jurors and public defenders who are perceived not to have done a good job and the guy gets sent away?
I think it's important to remember what the enhancement is for. The enhancement is not for any personal attack. The enhancement is for the attack on the state, and that is who's representing is the prosecutor of the state. Witnesses don't represent the state. They don't bring complaints. They do testify. And you're certainly right. There are individuals who, for no rational reason, fixate upon somebody and say, you know, that's the cause of my troubles. But in that courtroom, there really is only one person standing before the defendant and saying, I'm going to hold you accountable, and that's the prosecutor.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just have a quick note. I didn't see it, but are we going to have fiscal notes on these bills or something before we pass them out? I thought
Okay, I guess the answer is no.
We're not going to have fiscal notes.
It's too rare.
Usually a fiscal note would say that it's too rare. Usually we have something to that effect. But anyhow, and Mr. Bomister, I understand what you're saying, but isn't there a lot more danger to a witness? I mean, a witness is the one that can... While you're important in the courtroom, if the witness isn't there, if I can testify that the author of a bill, I saw him shoot somebody, if somebody kills me, that dismisses the case probably, or it's going to be hard to prove if there's no other evidence. If somebody shoots the prosecutor, they can still go after the person. So I'm just wondering on balance, so who's really in more danger?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulery.
Mr. Bomaster.
You actually did address that a few years back with tampering with a witness and killing a witness. We actually have a statute for that. For that very scenario, so I don't know that if you answer your own question with that.
Well, it doesn't go quite as far as this.
Well, I certainly don't object to you adding an enhanced penalty to that section of the law either. Again, I'm not here to speak out against any tinkering that you wish to do with those statutes. But I do think that it's important to understand that we have seen an increase in violence towards the prosecutors. I mean, I have, in my jurisdiction, been threatened. I've also prosecuted individuals who have threatened prosecutors. Had gone so far as trying to hire a hit person to kill the prosecutor. So I don't know if you want me to address all the different scenarios, but I do think that it's important from a societal standpoint to make it clear, just like we do with law enforcement officers, that the laws of this state will be enforced. And if you shoot the embodiment of those who we expect to enforce these laws, there will be an added penalty. You will be held accountable for that added assault or added crime against the state. Again, if somebody wishes to, you know, I cut them off and they shoot me, as Paul Bomaster, that's not enhanceable. But if they shoot me because I'm Paul Bomaster, the Rice County attorney, prosecuting them, upholding the laws of this state and holding them accountable for violating those laws, then there should be an added and enhanced penalty for that crime, which is against the community. I think Tim would tell you many people in his community felt assaulted, that it has disturbed the Grand Marais community, that it has had an impact on that community. There should be a penalty for that.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, Mr. Scannell.
Thank you. I personally believe that issue with regard to victims is a very important issue. It's not what was addressed in this particular piece of legislation. It's not something that we voted on at the County Attorneys Association board meeting. But personally, when I was assaulted after I realized that I was going to get through the incident, my biggest concern was that the courthouse was going to be closed. Obviously, this was a very traumatic event, and it was so sudden that no one knew kind of what our protocol was going to be, and I advocated as best I could in the situation that we needed to open the courthouse as quickly as we possibly could, because that is, again, the institution of our secular society, and it is something that we stand for as a community. And fortunately, we were able to get it open very quickly. I personally believe that when you attack a witness or you threaten a witness or you attack a juror or you threaten a juror, you are also attempting to undermine the process of justice in our society. And I'm not going to back away from arguing that we definitely need to have an enhanced penalty for assaults on prosecutors, but if this committee wanted to enhance penalties for assaults on witnesses or jurors or judges, that would also bolster the protections that we have of this process, which is the crucial process that goes on in our courthouses.
I'd like to just add one thing. We really appreciate you taking time to come down here and testifying.
Well, I really appreciate you having me here, so thank you.
I don't know if there's any other questions. I was just going to add one thing. There are dangers anytime you're working with crime. And I was just going to add one thing. I was a foreman of a jury that sent a young man to prison for second-degree murder, and I felt a little at ease, uneasy rather, for quite a number of years, wondering where his friends might be. So it is a dangerous business. Anyone else wishing to testify?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Representative Cornish, you can have a seat again. Open up for discussion. Questions of the author?
I would just like to thank the committee for their indulgence for the long period we spent on this, and also thank especially the prosecutor, Tim Scanlon, for his presence here today, being recently wounded and going through a horrific experience. And somebody else, also one of his colleagues, told me that his first concern was that the court stay open, even over and above his own safety and welfare. So I congratulate him on that, and all the rest of them for their expertise demonstrated here today. And if there's any other questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Otherwise, you can renew your motion.
I would like to move House File 1879 to pass and go to the General Register.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes, and House File 1879 goes to the General Register. Okay. While the chair is coming back to his seat, the Department of Corrections can proceed to the witness table.
Okay, we'll come back to order here, and the Department of Corrections, Ms. Carlson and Mr. Montgomery, this is the presentation for the Department of Corrections bonding portion?
That is correct.
Okay, you go ahead and identify yourself and begin, please.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Facilities Division for the Minnesota Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Montgomery. I'm a Capital Resource Director for the Department of Corrections.
Okay, welcome to both of you. You can proceed however you wish.
Thank you very much. We're happy to be here today. The Department of Corrections has four priorities in the Governor's Capital Bonding Recommendation. The total request for this agency is $53,699,000. Our first request is for $15 million for asset preservation. The Department of Corrections operates 10 facilities, 8 for adults and 2 for juveniles, and our prison population is approximately 9,400 offenders, adult offenders, and about 150 juvenile offenders. We use asset preservation money to protect the investments that have been made in our state facilities by making needed repairs to the infrastructure and building envelopes. We address building code and regulation compliance issues with asset preservation money, such as OSHA, Department of Health, Fire Marshal concerns. Asset preservation money also goes to building enhancement projects that improve the safety and security for all. Additionally, we use asset preservation money to replace old systems that are not energy efficient. We have an identified $86 million need for asset preservation within our facilities. So this $15 million will be used for our most critical projects that meet the goals that I've stated. As I said, we have facilities on 11 sites throughout the state. Many of these buildings are old and in need of very numerous ongoing repairs. Our Red Wing and our St. Cloud facilities were built in 1889, and our Stillwater facility was built in 1914. The Faribault and Moose Lake facilities are converted Department of Human Services regional treatment centers that we acquired in the late 80s. And these two facilities have been undergoing continual renovation to make the building safer for our prison settings. We use asset preservation money on projects in facilities throughout the state. Here are a couple photos that show some of our very visible asset preservation needs. We have a lot of tuck pointing needs. Our St. Cloud facility needs some extensive repair to the wall surrounding it. Facilities submit their asset preservation funding needs to us at central office, and we use a scoring matrix to make determinations and prioritize these requests. Life safety and security needs are our highest priorities. Projects that create energy savings and cost avoidance also get additional points. As I mentioned earlier, we ensure that we distribute the money throughout the facilities throughout the state, so we create jobs in all of these areas throughout the state. Some of our current projects include replacing burners on boilers, replacing windows in a number of facilities, doing elevator repairs, tuck pointing, bringing elevators into code compliance, door replacement, water treatment and well problems, air handling unit problems, pneumatic controls, shower renovations. The list goes on and on. The second project that I'm going to talk about is for our Shakopee facility. We request $5,407,000 to construct a perimeter fence at the correctional facility at Shakopee. This is our correctional facility that houses adult women offenders. This facility houses all custody level of offenders, from women serving life sentences for murder and others serving shorter sentences for nonviolent offenses. When this facility opened in 1986, the population was much lower than it was today. It was in the mid-80s, and now the population is about 550. Much has changed in these 25 years. We need a perimeter fence at this facility to improve public safety by reducing the risk of escape, reducing the risk of intrusion to the facility, and to reduce the risk of introduction of intrusion to the facility, and to reduce the risk of introduction of contraband. At the same time, we want to maintain a non-intrusive presence in the community. To show you how much the population has changed at the Shakopee Correctional Facility, we put together a bit of a comparison that can show the offense types and the population from 1986 to April of 2011. Because we don't have a fence, if there are serious security concerns with an offender, we'll either house the women in our segregation unit for a period of time or transfer her out of state via the Interstate Corrections Compact. Housing an escaped offender in our segregation unit is not a great long-term strategy for us within our facilities, because the offender would have very limited programming, and because we don't currently have enough room to house all the offenders who violate rules and create disturbances within that facility. Since 1995, 7 offenders have escaped from this facility. 15 have planned escape that we know about. And in the past few weeks, we've had 3 offenders in our segregation unit for escape concerns. Right now, we have 6 offenders housed out of state in other state facilities because of escape risk. Staff at the Shakopee facility spend an inordinate amount of time dealing with and using their skills to manage all of these security concerns because we do not have a fence. Here's an overhead map of the correctional facility. As you likely know, there are some citizens and neighbors of this prison who are very supportive of the fence and others who are not. We held meetings in the past month with neighbors of the prison to share information with them about the facility, the inmates we house, and some information about this project. We showed them what we conceptualized for a fence. And I'm going to show you. I am missing a slide. There it is. Okay, I'll show you this. This is a depiction of the fence that we are conceptualizing. The picture is a concept, it's not identical. The fence that we propose is 12 foot high, has masonry pillars and decorative iron pickets. There'd be a non-intrusive detection system interior to the fence to enhance security and alert us to escape attempts.
Ms. Carlson?
Yes.
You don't have to do it right now, but either now or at the end of your presentation about the fence, just kind of give the members an update in the history and the rub, why you haven't got one, and what the problem has been, and if you've come any closer to convincing the other side that you need one.
I'll be talking about that in just a few minutes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the design, really, I think that it really recognizes our interest in responding to the community concerns. The fence will meet our security needs, and we really do believe that it will address the needs and the interests of the community. This slide shows how the facility is located right in the heart of a community, in the part of a residential area. You can see the open space just above the MCF letters on the slide. This is where the old prison was located. That facility was constructed in 1919. So this facility has been around for a long time in the community of Shakopee. The surrounding area at that time, of course, was farmland. In the mid-1980s, the new facility was funded and constructed. By that time, many of the houses were built in the area surrounding the state property on which the facility is now located. Back in 1983, there was a study that was presented to the legislature, and at that time, there was in the drawings a partial fence around the facility, around components of the facility. I don't know for certain what happened with that. We don't know if it was funding related or what, but the study certainly had a fence included, and then that was taken out when the facility was designed. The other thing that we found in our history is that in the late 1970s, when we were in the old facility, the Shakopee City Council passed a resolution for a fence to be built around that prison at that point in time because there were some very high visible and high profile escapes of some very dangerous women offenders. So this is not a new issue to the community. We do want to be a good neighbor. We want to provide the appropriate level of security to address public safety concerns for the entire state. We need to construct a perimeter fence around this facility. We know of no other women's prison that houses all custody levels of offenders that does not have a fence around its perimeter. Here's just a couple of shots to show how close we are to the school. You can see from our colorful hedge in the foreground of the first picture. The school playground is right next to it. And also there's a end school zone and a no trespassing prison property sign right next to each other. It's important to recognize that not only does the fence keep inmates in, but it keeps intruders out of the facility. In the past 5 years, we have documented 18 intrusions onto the grounds of this facility. We've had school-aged kids coming onto grounds, some maybe on a dare. We've had citizens wander on the grounds, some not having a clue that they were coming onto the prison grounds. And also we've had unknown intruders in the dark hours of the night who, when staff approach them, they flee. And this is a very, very dangerous situation for the staff who have to approach these people that they don't know what their intent is for being there. And it really is a huge concern for us, especially with this intrusion aspect, that we want to provide a safe environment, as safe as possible for our staff to work. The other thing that you likely know is that a lot of women who are incarcerated have some very volatile relationships with others in their life. There's a lot of domestic abuse and violence issues that they have been involved with. And very honestly, we've had very realistic threats from ex-boyfriends or husbands who have called to say that they're going to come on grounds and harm the offender that's under our custody. And again, we're concerned about that for not only the offender's sake, but the staff's safety as well. We need the fence to deter someone from coming on grounds and causing harm to our staff, the offenders, and to protect the orderly operation of the facility. The Department of Corrections has been asking for funding for this fence for many years. Not having a fence is a significant security concern to the agency. We house dangerous, dangerous women offenders in this facility. Our mission is public safety. We need this additional feature to provide adequate safety and security to that community, to the state of Minnesota. We respectfully ask that you provide funding for this project, even though there are some people in the community who oppose it. Our third project is at the St. Cloud Correctional Facility. This is our intake facility for adult male offenders. This project has several components and costs $29,901,000. It includes construction of a new health service unit, remodeling existing space for intake, and construction of a loading dock and repurposing space for warehouse outside of the secure perimeter. This project is about improving safety for staff by improving the layout and addressing safety and security features
area. Excuse me for just a second. Representative Johnson, did you have a question that was relative to that part of the presentation, or did you want to wait?
Well, more just a brief process question with respect to the information we're getting now. Is this more just for your information so we know what's going on, or will we be providing some input regarding these bonding requests or ranking them in some form? Just curious as to how to take in the information, how I should be thinking about it.
Representative Johnson, that is such a good question. I'm going to wait for the chair to come back and give his thoughts on
that.
The real chair.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, go ahead, Ms. Carlson.
Thank you. Again, due to space constraints, we have an inadequate number of holding cells at our St. Cloud intake area, processing areas, staff areas, and we can't support the separation of offender movement into the facility and out of the facility, and I'll talk about that in more detail in just a few minutes. And additionally, the existing spaces aren't in compliance with building or accessibility codes to meet the needs of disabled offenders. The first component of this project is to construct a new health services area. The current space was designed to serve about 600 offenders, and the population today is about 1,000. The existing space is inadequate in both size and configuration to safely and efficiently deal with the increased population. In addition to the routine medical and dental appointments and exams that offenders participate in within this health service unit. The health service also supports some minor medical procedures and optometry, physical therapy. Offenders come to health services throughout the day for appointments. They come for sick call. They come for medication distribution, which we call pill window. It's a very, very busy place. Go back to this. This shows staff at a station that is an open area within the health service unit. This area has door control switches and other security equipment that should be within a secure area, not in an open, unprotected space where offenders could easily access. The new health service unit will have a secure staff station where door controls, camera monitoring equipment, and other security tools are located. Additionally, the new health service area will have more exam rooms because we have an inadequate number now. We'll have a larger room for treatment. The nurse's station will be also in a closed area. Our medication preparation area and our pill distribution areas will be enhanced. The gist of this project is that we need to create security enhancements for the staff. The existing space just isn't big enough, and it's not designed properly to be safe for the staff. The second component of this project is to, once the new health service area is built, is to renovate space for a new intake unit. Again, the existing space was designed to serve a population of 600 offenders with the facility, and we process many, many more inmates into this facility at this given time. As I said earlier, St. Cloud is our intake facility, and so all new commitments to our agency come first to St. Cloud for processing. We process about 700 offenders in and out of the facility every month. This space was poorly designed and doesn't adequately or safely meet our needs. We need to be able to physically and visually separate those incoming and outgoing offenders. The hallways are very, very narrow, and it's not good security practice to have those offenders who are getting on transport into transport vehicles from the facility, and inmates who are coming into our facility from sheriff's transports or our Department of Corrections secure transportation to intermingle in the hallways. And right now, that is what the design of our area is. Offenders arrive at St. Cloud, like I said, by either our secure transport bus or by sheriff's transport. Many of these offenders are unknown to us, and we don't know what their level of violence is. We don't know much more about what security risks they pose. So this project includes construction of a secure vehicle sally port to give us efficient and secure movement in and out of the facility. It also involves creating more holding cells for offenders. The picture you show here is the first stop for offenders in our intake area. It's a holding cell. Ideally, we wouldn't have more than 3 to 5 offenders in a holding cell at any given time. But due to our layout and the number of cells that we have often up to 30 inmates together in a holding cell during processing. Additionally, our current cells are not compliant with ADA regulations for meeting the needs of disabled offenders who are brought into our facilities.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Representative Maury, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any kind of standards? I mean, that seems extremely dangerous to me to have 30 violent prisoners in a room that's uncontrolled, and you say it's happened often, not just once or twice. Is there any kind of standards nationally for that? It just seems bizarre to me to allow that.
Ms. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I'm not aware of any specific standard on that issue.
The American Corrections Association, which we are not certified by, does have a standard related to how much space for a cell, for a typical occupancy, for a residential unit. but it doesn't really describe specifics for a holding cell like this, other than you have to have adequate space there for them to, you know, to sit and to be held. That's all.
Okay. Ms. Carlson, continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, the hallways are very narrow in this area, and when disturbances occur, the space is very tight and very close for the staff to manage as they remove offenders to another location when they're fighting. And in addition to the tight quarters, there's not adequate space for all the functions that need to occur in the intake area. Staff currently are using storage closets to conduct interviews and have screening of offenders when numerous offenders are being processed simultaneously. So that does also respond to the question that you asked. There are many, many concerns about safety issues within this current structure. There's also lack of usable showers for the offenders, inadequate space for private medical or mental health screenings, and inadequate space for property transfer, search, and distribution. These will all be corrected with the new construction. The third component of this project is to construct a loading dock and a secure receiving area outside of the perimeter. There are numerous benefits that will greatly enhance security. Currently, all delivery trucks must enter the facility through the truck gate, and trucks must be searched before they can enter the secure facility. Anytime a truck enters the facility, the risk for contraband introduction or the risk for escape exists. With the addition of a loading dock on the outside of the perimeter, trucks would unload and all products would be stored in a warehouse space until staff are able to search them thoroughly, visually, and also with metal detectors before we would move them into our facility on our time frame. We project that 90% of the truck gate traffic would be eliminated and diverted to this exterior loading dock with the construction of this loading dock. This is a significant security enhancement for this facility, since currently we have over 1,000 vehicles entering the facility per quarter for deliveries and other reasons. Our fourth project is a well and water treatment project at the Stillwater facility. We're requesting $3.391 million for this project. Stillwater operates two wells. Well 1 was installed in 1914 and doesn't comply with the Department of Health regulations because it's too close to a sanitary sewer line. This is the current backup well for the facility. Well 2 was installed in 1961 and serves as the main water source for the facility. This project includes installing a new well that would become the main water source for the facility, capping and sealing of the 1914 well, installing a new system that would remove the high iron content and also efficiently treat the water, replacing piping that's close to failure due to rust and corrosion, and constructing a new building to house the water treatment equipment. This project is an urgent and very, very critical need for the facility. Over 10 years ago, the Department of Health started telling us that we needed to stop using the 1914 well or move the sanitary sewer lines that run near that well. This year, the Department of Health made a point that they will not allow us to continue to operate the 1914 well. We need two wells at this facility to provide adequate water supply for fire suppression, and also to be a backup in case the primary well fails, because this facility is of such a great size and it's so complex. We need to have two wells. These photos show the corroded pipes that could fail at any time and are in need of replacement. The current water treatment equipment has failed two times in the last month. And when this equipment fails, the facility loses water pressure and it causes a large-scale disruption in the facility, including in the laundry area and in the dining, in the kitchen area with the dishwashers and food prep. Also, offenders not being able to flush toilets or shower for a period of time also causes serious problems in our facilities. In addition, the current equipment is not environmentally or economically efficient. We spend about $50,000 a year on salt. The new system will filter the water first and remove iron and radon, making it easier to soften before it's then chemically treated. The processes are more effective and efficient and will also have the benefit of improving the longevity of other equipment like our industrial dishwashers, our laundry equipment, and other equipment that the water flows through. The current water treatment system is located in the same building as an emergency generator, and these two functions are really not compatible with each other. The chemicals that are used to treat the water at their full strength are very, very corrosive and cause damage to this building. The building itself is not conducive to water treatment and distribution. The new building will be a simple, secure warehouse-style construction that houses water filters, softeners, transfer pumps, chemical distribution and storage areas, and also distribution piping and small control office.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question.
I know we're running short on time, but
yeah, please.
I guess it's an obvious thing probably, but this is still water you're talking about?
Yes.
City of Stillwater does not have its own water system?
Mr. Chair and Representative.
Ms. Carlson.
The city of Bayport and also Oak Park Heights have their own water systems.
Mr. Montgomery, go ahead.
The facility is actually located in Bayport. It's called Stillwater, but it's in Bayport. So we deal with the city of Bayport.
Okay, but their water system is not adequate to service you then, is that right?
Not at this time, no.
Okay.
I would like to clarify a question that Representative Johnson asked a minute ago, although he's left, is that our intention here is to hear from the Department of Corrections, Department of Public Safety, and then we've got a few more. We'll hear on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday we'll present a list of priorities for submission to the Capital Improvement Committee. Any questions about that? Representative Maury?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I thought you might.
So we'll present a list to them. Will we take a position on each request and then even portions of requests and then yes or no and then rank the yeses, or just how will we do that? Will it be a formal kind of thing or just a...
We will rank those, yeah, per... we will not rank. I'm sorry. We will not rank those, Representative Mulder. What did you want to do with them? No, we will not rank them. We'll just give a recommendation for the Capital Improvement Committee on which one of these we... I tell you what, let me ask Representative Cornish, instead of me fumbling through this, our intent is to... And you fill in the blank.
I feel strongly both ways, but I think that I heard a ranking and then I heard no ranking, but we'll get back to you with the specifics, whether it's going to be... Personally, I would rather not make the decision. I'd rather pass them all to the bond committee and let them do it rather than have disappointed faces here. But we'll get back to you, Representative Mulder. Thank you.
So, Representative Mulder, we will either rank them or not rank them. Hopefully that will.
Thank you for being so specific.
Could you
present the third possibility?
We're going to limit it to two possibilities this time. Are there any questions for the Department of Corrections on their bonding request?
I have one question.
Representative,
I'm assuming this first time I've ever seen bonding requests come through. I guess this is that's why they call this a bonding year. I'm assuming that this is already in the governor's bonding bill request, so everything that we're going to see from this department, the other department, apparently is already on his list.
That's correct. But Ms. Carlson, would you like to add anything to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, these are in the governor's bonding recommendation, and all four are very critical projects to our agency. I'd also like just to take a moment to say in response to Representative Cornish's comment earlier that the support for the Shakopee fence is given by the mayor of the city as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson. Representative Maury, go ahead.
Thank you. Just one question. I always ask, what does the representative from the area see for or against this?
Ms. Carlson?
I'm not sure who it is, but
I believe it's Representative Beard.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is my understanding that he supports the fence as long as it's with the current design, with the masonry pillars and decorative picket.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair.
Ms. Carlson, just a couple quick questions. You know, you said there were people who might oppose this in Shakopee. Why or why not?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Carlson.
Representative Grunhagen. We held some community meetings in the last couple of weeks, and some of the people in the area are concerned that the look of the fence will give the appearance of a dangerous facility. They have concerns that it may jeopardize their property values. Some have said that they've lived in the area for a long, long time and haven't had a problem with the facility as it is, and would just anticipate that that would continue to be the case.
Okay, Mr. Representative Grunhagen.
Ms. Carlson, next question. Appreciate that answer. What if you can get these things done under cost? I think the total is $86 million. So let's say you're able to complete them for $80 million. What happens to the $6 million? Does it come back to the general fund, or what happens?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm not sure what $80 million you're referring to.
Oh, the inside of the first asset is $86 million total needed, it says.
Oh.
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, we're requesting $15 million for asset preservation. We have an identified need of $86 million, so how we'll prioritize our projects that would be funded out of that $86 million need is to really focus on the most critical for our facilities. And that money gets spread throughout all of the facilities through the state.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunhagen.
Let's say it costs $13 million and there's $2 million left. What happens to that money?
Ms. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, we request authority to use money that is not spent on an asset preservation project to be used on other asset preservation or other projects of asset preservation nature in the facility where the funding has been located.
Okay, so you'd...
Representative Grunhagen?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Carlson, so you basically would just use it to do other projects that are on the list.
Ms. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, last question.
Representative Grunhagen?
Are these repairs under prevailing wage law?
Ms. Carlson? Mr. Montgomery?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they are all. We worked this through the... Materials and Management Division, and they're the ones that do the actual contracting and through the Department of Administration, and it's all done under the prevailing wage law.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no other questions for the Department of Corrections, we are right at 12 o'clock hour. If we hear from Public Safety, I think we have a guarantee it won't go past 12 minutes, which probably means 15 minutes. Depending on questions, if it's okay with the committee, we'll run over. But I'll defer. Representative Morey, do you have a, as you walk out the door, is there any preference? We can hear this on next week, or we can allow, we'll go ahead and hear it then, with no preference.
I know.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And just as you're preparing there, a reminder to members to make sure you keep your PowerPoints in the save folder. Because as we discuss this going into next week, it would be good information for you to have with you. Okay, could you state your name for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Eide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which is a division of the Department of Public Safety. What I will be presenting to you today is our one and only and number one priority of our bonding request this year for the State Emergency Operations Center, which is managed by my division. The project scope is for the State Emergency Operations Center and for the permanent offices for our Homeland Security and Emergency Management staff. Over the last 3 years, we have been averaging activation at about 45 days during the last 3 years. And so far this year, on the 5th of January, we were already activated for an alert condition at the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant. The State Emergency Operations Center is where all state agency staff meet to coordinate and to provide assistance to local governments during any kind of an emergency or a disaster. Homeland Security and Emergency Management currently has 75 full-time employees. This project is designed to also possibly co-locate two other Department of Public Safety programs which were involved in our pre-design process, and that would be the Minnesota Duty Officer that has six employees, and the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, which is our state's fusion center, which has 18 employees on a daily basis. As I mentioned, the role of the State Emergency Operations Center is to coordinate state agency response, to communicate with those local emergency operations centers, members of the incident command at the scene, and also to coordinate activities with the federal government. In addition, we provide support to the scene. If they need state responses, if they need mutual aid from other local governments, we do that from the State Emergency Operations Center. We also coordinate the public information. That's one of the priorities of emergency management, is to make sure that we are all speaking with one voice, or we all know what the other agencies and the other jurisdictions are all saying. So that is the role of the State Emergency Operations Center, is to coordinate the information and the directions to the public when we have an emergency or a disaster. The characteristics of an emergency operations center that are required by the federal government are survivability, security, sustainability, interoperability, and flexibility. Per the Department of Homeland Security, each state and every local jurisdiction is required to have one primary emergency operations center and one alternate emergency operations center, this to act as the state's command center. Our current location, which is down in Town Square in downtown St. Paul, does not meet these core capabilities for the Department of Homeland Security purposes. And we always like to say that that we respond well as the state of Minnesota despite our emergency operations center, not because of our emergency operations center. Here's a little bit about our shortfalls when it comes to survivability. We are in a high-risk area. So in the 90s, the Federal Emergency Management Agency determined that emergency operations centers should no longer be in basements of state capitals, which is where all state emergency operations centers were. So we were asking for a new emergency operations center at that time. As the Department of Public Safety moved to downtown in Town Square, we moved with them. We are in a high-risk area. We're in a high-traffic area amongst the city streets of downtown St. Paul, and we are adjacent to high-rises. The requirements of the Department of Homeland Security are that you need to be 10 feet away for every floor of a high-rise building, and we definitely are not. These are pictures that are taken from our front door, from our side door, and looking directly out of our emergency operations center. From the security standpoint, we are in the worst of all worlds from the security standpoint. We're in our current location. We are above ground. You don't necessarily have to be below ground, but it is recommended that at least a portion of your emergency operations center do be below ground. We have inadequate security. We have direct entry, and we are above a parking ramp on a food court next to, directly adjacent to a public hotel in the middle, and fairly soon next to the light rail system.
Ms. Heidi, excuse me real quick.
Sure.
On so the selection of the current site, was that before these requirements from Department of Homeland Security, from the federal department?
Mr. Chair, that was before the requirements. The Department of Homeland Security actually was not a department until 2002. So this was before the attacks of September 11th, when all of these core capabilities were brought together. The Department of Homeland Security was created, and the new requirements for EOCs were developed.
Okay, and when we call these requirements, are these this statute, or is this recommendations from the federal department? What's the criteria there?
These are studies that had been conducted, and the requirements for any emergency operations center that is the anti-terrorism force protection, and the core capabilities of a state emergency management system. So it is guidelines, recommendations, requirements for some of our grant funding that we meet core capabilities. In our current situation, we do not.
Okay, thank you. Continue, Ms. Heidi. Thank you.
From our sustainability standpoint, we are in leased space. Our landlord controls our heating and air conditioning system, which obviously for any kind of chemical incident is not sufficient. We have no air filtration. We only have one telecom entry, so we don't have redundant regular landline system. And for those of you that have ever been in the Capitol for numerous hours, you know that food service is an important thing, and we only have food service on a daily basis because we don't have a kitchen in our facility. From communication interoperability, we are in a communication dead spot because of the high rises around us. We need to relay it to the DOT, so we need to actually have lines and microwave links to the DOT building. We have to pay for space on the roof, again, to the landlord for our antennas. And we really have a situation there where we don't have, we can't trust the communication systems that we do have. From a flexibility standpoint, we do have a flexible emergency operations right now where we share the rooms for conference rooms, for training. We simply have inadequate space. If we are activated as we were 45 days last year, then we cannot do any of our meetings or training that we have in our space. We were activated for the duration of the Republican National Convention in 2008, and this is right outside our door. So we have quite a bit of vulnerability. Some of the public knew we were there. They were banging on our doors. We were smelling tear gas. We were hearing the flashbangs. So we were in a pretty vulnerable spot during that event. This is the Tuscaloosa, Alabama Emergency Operations Center. This was a brand new Tuscaloosa, Alabama Emergency Operations Center last May before the tornadoes hit. They chose to build a standard building. They housed it with the other public safety functions. And when the tornado hit, direct hit on their building, this is what happened when they didn't have the survivability built in to their facility, and we want to make sure that we don't have that happen here. So our current status, the legislature passed in 2010 $2.25 million for a pre-design and design. We have completed our pre-design. Also in the law, it was required that we conduct a traffic study to make sure that our responders could get to the new Emergency Operations Center in a timely fashion. That has been completed. The pre-design has been completed. We have received the required recommendations from the House Ways and Means and the Senate Finance Committee chairs. Our construction manager has been selected and is on board for the design, so that company then would be the construction manager if we are successful in getting the $26 million that we are here to request today. So from our pre-design, which was inclusive of not only Homeland Security Emergency Management staff, but all other state agencies, local government, and different associations that utilize our services. It ends up being 52,200 square feet. It needs between 15 and 20 acres, depending on the plot of land. We need to have parking for 180 cars, so that's been included. We need to have controlled access into the facility, but we also need to have some places where we can have the media also come so that they don't get into the controlled area. We have to harden our mission-critical areas. We have designed a robust information technology and audio-visual capabilities. One of the designers made the comment that's absolutely accurate in that an emergency operations center is technology with a building wrapped around it. And that's exactly what we are intending to do. We need to have redundant power and communication systems. When we did the pre-design, we put the whole package together, and we actually came up with about 65,000 square feet. So we wanted to make sure that we were being as conservative as we could be. So because this is adjacent to the National Guard facilities at the Arden Hills Army Training Site, we were able to reduce our plan by 13,000 square feet by being able to utilize some of their facilities for our heated storage, for our vehicle storage, because we do own vehicles, we own a command post. They have commercial kitchens, fitness center, showers, those kinds of things that that we could utilize in their buildings. So we are here today to request $26 million, which is included in the governor's recommendation. This breaks down the costs for you. So the cost of a 52,200 square foot building is $8.5 million. That's what we would get if we built the Tuscaloosa, Alabama model. The sustainability, which meets all the Minnesota requirements for green issues, is $700,000. The hardening of our facility to anti-terrorism force protection recommendations and redundancy is $10.3 million. The technology and the audiovisual is $3.5 million. And the other construction-related costs are $3 million, which is the preparation of the site and those types of things. So this is the space plan, not the actual design. But what you see here is we have the EOC itself, which is our main floor for all the responders. We have our offices, the core of some of our training, our heating, our the fusion center, our duty officer space, that's all in the core area. And then we have a media and training center off to the side, which is where we would have our joint information center. Around is the parking spot for 90 vehicles on a daily basis, and then 180 for the times we are activated. The impact of not funding this is we would continue to have risks posed by our current location. We would continue to not meet the federal requirements and limit possibly our capability. And the big thing that that I think I want to make sure that people understand is we still pay rent where we are. We pay almost $1 million a biennium to rent the space we're in, which is less than half the size and less than half the capability of this new facility. So we are still continuing to pay somebody else instead of owning this facility so that we can have a state-of-the-art facility to respond to emergencies and disasters in the state of Minnesota. And with that, I made my 12 minutes.
Representative Kelly.
just curious, Mr. Chair and society, you gave us one example of the national convention that you're called out on. Is there any other thing that's not weather related that you had called on, or what are some other examples?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, we activate for things like the Prairie Island Nuclear Generating Plant with the alert condition on the 5th of January. So a lot of our requirements in our EOC really are based on the requirements of the federal government to be able to respond to a nuclear power plant incident. We also respond to chemical fires, Epoxical in South St. Paul, the St. Charles fire. We respond to those. Any kind of terrorism incident, we would respond to. Most are weather related. Most are floods or tornadoes, severe weather, and that requires 24-hour because we are providing services on a 24-hour basis.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Ahe. Just a couple questions. I was just,
and see if I got these figures accurate. You said the facility down south that was it in Georgia?
Alabama.
That was damaged? Yeah. If I got that right, it was $8.5 million for a similar type facility of 52,000 square feet. You divide that out, that's about $162 a square foot. Okay, and I just did that quickly. You'd take our facility at 26 million, you subtract out the technology, so you got a 22.5 million. Divide that by 52,200 square feet, you got about $431 a square foot. Okay, so we're more than doubling the cost, and maybe that's reasonable, but the what if you come under bid? Let's assume you get this project for whatever reason, and you're $3 million. I just know from being on the school board for 16, yeah, right. But that a lot of the people who bid the bids, the architect firms, they build in a certain cushion, okay, for unexpected. Well, about 80% of the time, according to the information I've been given, all the unexpected they might not know about don't show up. So it usually comes under a lot of times. Sometimes over, sometimes under. But again, if we're $3 million short or don't use, does that money come back to the general fund or it stays with your organization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the building will cost what the building costs. We did cut out certain things. You may notice if you were to read the project, we actually asked for $26,534,000, and the governor recommended $26 million. So what we've done is we have removed certain things from that. There's a couple of options. One would be that we only sell the bonds for $26 million. The other is that we would then add back in the things that that we had to cut because of the limits that we had.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunhagen,
Ms. ID, ID. Okay, got a friend. Ed, I spelled a little different, but so basically, the money would be used someplace else then. If I understand your response,
Mr. Chair, Grunhagen, that could be possible.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one last question.
Representative Grunhagen.
Director Heidi, is this under the prevailing wage law?
Ms. Heidi.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, this is managed by the Department of Administration, so it would be my assumption. I can't be 100% sure, but it would be my assumption that, yes, it is.
Okay.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Heidi. Hearing no other questions from members, we will stand adjourned and we'll continue this conversation tomorrow.
Tuesday.
Tuesday. Forgot today was Thursday. Meeting adjourned.